All these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News, hello, I'm Eileen McHugh. The White House says the third most senior Hamas commander in Gaza was killed in an Israeli operation last week. The death of Marwan Issa was announced by the White House National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan. He also said the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, had agreed to send a delegation to Washington to discuss plans for a ground offensive in Rafah in southern Gaza.
More than 1 million people have taken refuge in Rafah. They went from Gaza City to Khan Yunis and then to Rafah. And they have nowhere else to go. Gaza's other major cities have largely been destroyed. And Israel has not presented us or the world with a plan for how or where they would safely move those civilians, let alone feed and house them and ensure access to basic things like sanitation.
Donald Trump's lawyers say the former U.S. president can't obtain a multi-million dollar bond that would allow him to appeal against a judgment in his civil fraud case in New York. The lawyers said negotiations with bond companies had been unsuccessful. Here's Neda Taufik.
Today, his lawyer said in a court filing that he can't get a bond for more than $100 million. They say they've reached out to 30 different bond companies, and very few of them would give him a bond in the magnitude needed. We're talking about more than $450 million that he needs. And the very few that were willing, they said, weren't comfortable enough with just accepting his real estate as collateral. They wanted him to back the bond with cash or stocks. And so they said this has made it practically impossible for them to get a bond.
He now has to find $500 million in cash, or New York State can start seizing his properties. Media reports say U.S. Supreme Court judges seem inclined to reject a judicial move to limit the federal government's power to pressure social media companies to moderate extreme content or misinformation. A majority of justices from across the ideological spectrum expressed concern about imposing such restrictions. MPs in the Gambia have voted to revoke a ban on female genital mutilation, removing legal protections for millions of girls. A clear majority of the National Assembly voted in favour of a bill to overturn the ban. Human rights activists say overturning the 2015 ban will undo decades of work. Nimco Ali is co-founder of the Five Foundation, which campaigns to end FGM.
But outside the assembly today were thousands of young Gambian women who've all been through FGM. So the reality is that the women of Gambia are against FGM, and the average age of FGM in Gambia is at the age of 5. So this is not even happening to adults, it's happening to babies and children. This legislation has actually been powerful in the sense that numbers are going down in terms of young girls being cut. But the reality is where there is progress, there's always pushback.
World News from the BBC. Vladimir Putin has addressed a triumphant crowd in Moscow's Red Square a day after he claimed a landslide presidential election victory. The rally marks the 10th anniversary of Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. Mr. Putin told the crowd that all occupied Ukrainian territories were now part of new Russia. Western nations have condemned the election as a sham, as no serious opposition was allowed. Washington said there would be no congratulatory calls from the US. The European Union has agreed to increase military support for Ukraine by nearly $5.5 billion. It will be available for training and procurement of equipment and arms, including those sourced outside the EU. Ukraine's armed forces chief, Oleksandr Sirsky, says he's looking for asymmetric solutions to gain an advantage over Russian forces, who are numerically superior. At least 10 dead bodies have been removed from Pentonville, an affluent suburb of the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. Local witnesses said they didn't know the circumstances of the deaths, but spoke of an attack by armed criminals early on Monday. From there, Will Grant.
The latest violence serves as a reminder, if anyone needed, that Haiti remains closer to anarchy than stability. And that makes it almost impossible for so many here to lead anything that resembles their normal lives amid the chaos.
The gangs have such a grip of Haiti, they are in essence dictating what happens next in this country, who can govern it, who lives in it, and who dies.
The US software giant NVIDIA has unveiled its latest artificial intelligence chip, which it claims is a huge leap forward from its existing market leader. The company's chief executive said the new Blackwell B200 chip has 208 billion transistors, making it more than twice as powerful at training AI models than the company's previous chip. BBC News.
This is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are your headlines tonight.
Early voting in Wisconsin for the April election begins tomorrow. The presidential primary elections for both parties are on the ballot, although both parties' nominations are largely decided. Also on the ballot are two constitutional amendments for Wisconsin, both of which revolve around regulating state elections. The two amendments on the ballot stem from unfounded election controversy in 2020. We'll have more on those amendments later this week. There are also some local races on the ballot, and voters can preview their ballot online at My Vote Wisconsin.
Eric Hovde, a Republican candidate for the United States Senate, has pledged to donate his salary to charity. That pledge is part of a new campaign ad that was released on Friday. The move comes as negative ads have called the candidate's Wisconsin connection into question, pointing out his excessive residence and business connections in California, reports the Associated Press. Hovde is likely to be the Republican nominee running against incumbent Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Hovde first has to win the primary race in August before appearing on the ballot in November. Hovde's net worth was $52 million back in 2012 when he last ran for Senate. He has indicated that he is likely to spend some of his own money in the race, perhaps as much as $20 million.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice announced that a Missouri-based company will have to pay $2.5 million in penalties. That's after a court found that Relief Solutions International had sent thousands of illegal mailers to Wisconsin residents, luring them into sales presentations for timeshare exit services. The decision bars the owners from doing business in Wisconsin and also requires the company to provide refunds of $20,000 to specifically identified Wisconsin consumers, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Wisconsinites who paid for services for Relief Solutions International can reach out to the Department of Justice's Public Protection Unit for assistance in securing the refund.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison is seeking vendors to provide new marketing and public relations materials. Those materials will be used to counter perceptions that the school is elitist or leftist, reports the Capital Times. The new marketing campaign is unusual in that it's very explicit in its goals to lobby state politicians. Specifically, the university is seeking more financial support in next year's budget negotiations. The university had a contentious round of budget negotiations with the state government last year. The state's university system received more than $32 million in budget cuts and had to end programs associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion. Public funding for the state university has declined as a portion of the total university budget since the 1970s, and tuition and private donations have risen to pick up the slack. Meanwhile, confidence in higher education has fallen sharply, according to a national poll released by Gallup last year. In the last year, the University of Wisconsin announced that it would be shuttering several satellite campuses, primarily due to low enrollment. Tight budgets and state cuts have also led to layoffs and furloughs through the university system.
Crandon Elementary School in upstate Wisconsin will be closed for the rest of March. That's following a carbon monoxide poisoning incident last week. 39 students, staff, and EMS workers received medical attention, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The incident is similar to one that occurred in a dorm at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus in 2022, when 17 students were hospitalized due to carbon monoxide poisoning. Current state law does not require carbon monoxide detectors in schools, although they are required in Wisconsin residences. Crandon Elementary is currently planning on reopening in April, though the exact nature of the leak has yet to be determined.
Madison Metropolitan School District's Assistant Superintendent for Financial Services cautioned the school board about its sustainability goals, namely that using 100% renewable energy by 2040 is, quote, almost impossible, reports the Capital Times. Currently, most of the district's schools use natural gas to provide heating. To meet the goal, 9 schools would have to be closed each year for renovations, straining the district's capacity. Those renovations would also cost the district approximately $1 billion to complete. The assistant superintendent laid out other paths for green energy planning, including a plan for zero greenhouse gas emissions and a timeline that aims for 2050 instead of 2040. Meanwhile, the district is currently operating on a budget deficit with a $12 million shortfall projected for next year. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
In just 2 weeks, Dane County voters will decide who sits on the county board. District 34 represents McFarland, and its incumbent supervisor, Patrick Miles, is running to retain his seat. Miles is also currently serving as chair of the county board. Earlier today, his challenger, Ed Ray, spoke to WORT News producer Faye Parks to discuss his priorities for the district.
Thank you for joining me, Ed.
Thank you for having me.
So, to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what political experience do you have?
A little bit about me. I was born in Liberia. My parents moved here when I was 8 years old, seeking better opportunity for my siblings and I. As a first-generation American, I have always had a call to serve my country and my community. This country has given me a lot. My community has had services that give me a lot. And so it's one of the reasons why I decided to join the U.S. Army National Guard, because I wanted to give back to my country. It's also why I joined the Village of McFarland as a trustee, and it's been an honor to represent my community and be a voice and bring in those new voices. It's also why I volunteer within our McFarland schools and also serve as a mentor for kids of formerly incarcerated parents. But it's been a good experience because I've learned so much about myself, as I'm sure they've learned from me. Professionally, I work as a senior consultant for Nordic Global, big data nerd. I help use data analysis, medical software to really address population health and improve healthcare. As a trustee for the Village of McFarland, I've been champions for our environments, for seniors, public safety, for open, inclusive government. I've chaired the Public Safety Committee as well as the Public Works Committee. Started off my campaign, I was honored to be endorsed by former Sheriff Dave Mahoney, State Representative Radcliffe, and over 75 community leaders, teachers, business owners, people who are in my community and have seen my impact and my commitment to this community. My focus really has always been on bringing new voices and new perspective into village government. I always encourage my friends to vote local, be the voice you want to see or the change you want to see in your community. And I really have worked hard to bring people together, especially when we have tough challenges. And so as the next supervisor for District 34, that is going to be my focus. And I'm going to do my best and focus on the people that I'm elected to serve.
This weekend, almost a third of your potential colleagues accused you of running a smear campaign against incumbent supervisor Patrick Miles. So this all hinges on a significant budget vote the Dane County Board made to divert food assistance funding to the Bayview Project. Where do you believe your opponent erred in that decision?
We have different priorities, right? I would not have voted to cut $1.5 million from food banks, especially at a time where we've seen increased needs.
So I do want to push back a little bit on that. You mentioned there was the $1.5 million cut, but then just a few weeks later, the board did vote to allocate about $1.7 million into Second Harvest Food Bank. Do you believe that makes up for that initial vote, the initial budget vote?
The facts are clear that Patrick Miles voted to cut. All of that is public information. The video, he's claiming he never made the vote. I'm not going to debate with my opponent on what is factual. There were 4 amendments put forward to remove those fundings. As I understand it, those funds, after it was cut, county board supervisors had to approach the county executive office to find those funding. So he didn't even have to do it, to be completely frank. He voted to cut $1.5 million when he did not need to, especially when there's increased needs. We had food pantries reaching out asking, please do not cut it. And he still went forward with that. We have different priorities. And my community deserves better.
So this year, the county's operating and capital budgets total about $970 million, but that money is finite. So Dane County provides significant funding for all kinds of social services, everything from affordable housing to food assistance. What are your priorities when it comes to funding such causes?
I am here to represent my community. And one of the issues that the voters of my community care about is affordable housing. And I appreciate the county's increased investment in their affordable housing. One of the things that people also overlook is that as we've increased investment in affordable housing, we've also seen an increased needs in food pantry. You add a pandemic to that, there are hungry people and there are hungry families, and we have to make sure that we take care of the people that we're elected to represent. Part of that is, and we've done it in the village of McFarland, is working with our local developers, working with nonprofits. The county needs to work with the feds and the state. And we have to make sure that our housing strategy is not about building homes, but about creating supportive community. But we also have to look at integrating services as well, childcare, transportation, access to healthy food. And so I appreciate some of the investment the county has done around affordable housing. I think we also can do better, and we have to reimagine our strategies.
I know that criminal justice reform is also a big talking point this year. What is your perspective on that?
I will say that's a good question. And I would like to answer a little bit broadly about racial inequity first. So I'm a person of color. I'm a Black person. And I think we need to blend empathy. We also have to have a little bit of understanding, and we have to have some tangible action. As a Black person, I know firsthand about racism, about discrimination, and the bias that people like me have lived, especially people of color. Here in the village of McFarland, I helped create the first D&I position. I helped secure the necessary votes in face of opposition for that. I also chaired the Public Safety Committee on the village of McFarland. Police forces have to mirror the diverse communities that they serve. And we have to ensure that officers are trained in both law enforcement, but also understanding the cultural fabric that they are part of. And so it's not easy, right? Because if it was, we wouldn't be having these conversations. But we also have to look at different ways to strengthen our communities. Restorative justice needs to be taken further, moving away from punitive systems to one that really focuses on healing and rehabilitation. All that to answer your question is there is a need, and there are a lot of strategies. I've been a champion for that in my community. And as a county board supervisor, I intend to continue to move that forward.
So meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race? And if elected to the county board, how do you plan to handle that transition?
I think Dane County is an amazing county. I'm proud to live here. I applaud some of the work that he's done. And I'm not sure who the next county executive is going to be, but as I have on as a village trustee working for an administrator, I intend to work with our county executive to make sure that there is alignment, that there's a shared vision, there is support. In my personal opinion, I think right now there's a little bit of division on the county board. There needs to be a stronger partnership between the board and the county executive to be good stewards of our tax dollars and represent the communities that we are elected to serve in a meaningful way.
Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
On a personal level, throughout my tenure on the village board, I've always been committed to elevating diverse voices and perspectives. And that's a commitment that I plan to carry forward as a supervisor for District 34. I have worked really hard to reach underrepresented groups. If we want to have a more inclusive environment, we have to be sure that we meet people where they're at. And so I'm committed to continuing to listen and seeking out diverse voices. I plan to implement more community engagement, utilizing both traditional platforms as well as some innovative ways. As the next supervisor of District 34, I will work very hard in making sure that we have regular communications with our minority groups, with youth organizations, and the community segments. And I will be a champion, not just in words, but in action, to address the unique needs of our diverse communities, ensuring that we have equitable access to government resources and services. Unfortunately, my opponent has been in this office way too long, 23 years in politics altogether, I believe. And he has lost touch with the community and what matter most to the people he's elected to serve. It's truly time for a change, and I look forward to bringing not just new ideas, but new energy, new perspective, and representing the people of District 34 on the county board.
Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me, Ed.
Thank you.
That was Ed Ray, one of two candidates vying for the District 34 seat on the Dane County Board.
The current time right now is 6:20 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news right here on WORT.
We're now going to hear from District 34's incumbent supervisor, Patrick Miles. He shared his priorities with WORT news producer Faye Parks earlier today.
Thank you for joining me, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background, and what are some of your accomplishments since being elected to the county board?
I work in the public sector for the state, developing public sector finance applications, and I've been doing that for about 20 years, first as a small business owner and consultant, and now as an employee for the state of Wisconsin Department of Administration. Well, I started in public service in the village board in McFarland in 2001 and served three terms there. And was elected to the county board in 2006. And this term, my colleagues elected me as the first person of color to chair the board. Some of my accomplishments, I will start with my proudest achievement is bringing the Lower Yahara River Trail to McDaniel Park in McFarland from Lake Farm Park. That project, it took over 8 years to bring to fruition, and I think it demonstrates my tenacity and perseverance to do the hard work to get things done. And I'm happy to say we'll be opening phase two of that trail from Fish Camp Park down to Lake Gonza State Park later this year. Some other accomplishments more immediate are the investment we've made to date, over $41 million, almost $42 million in the Affordable Housing Development Fund. That's produced over 2,500 units of affordable housing units countywide and 98 right here in McFarland where I live. Another achievement that I'm proud of is the establishment of the PACE Wisconsin program and getting Dane County to be an early member of that. I helped shape some of the program guidelines for that. And what this program is it reduces the financing costs for clean energy and energy efficiency improvements to existing or new commercial development. We're up to about 55 counties as members now. And for the last 2 years, that membership has elected me to chair the statewide commission. And Dane County has received the greatest concentration of projects that have created here more than 600 jobs and reduced our CO2 emissions by more than 7,200 metric tons each year. And then this last budget, I'm proud of the work that my colleagues and I did to create one of the most progressive budgets that I think truly impacts people's lives for the better. From our expansion of crisis care response to, again, affordable housing options and investment in significant resources in food access and food security.
So speaking of food security, this weekend, 13 of your colleagues on the county board accused your opponent, Ed Ray, of running a smear campaign against you. So in a letter to the editor published in the Cap Times, they countered his claim that you voted to cut food pantry funding from the latest budget. Is there anything you'd like to add to their statement?
Well, I greatly appreciate my colleagues for stepping up and, in a sense, I guess, having my back, because it's pretty discouraging to see that my opponent has been making an effort to misrepresent my record. You know, it's pretty clear in trying to add credibility to his case, he keeps telling people to refer to a State Journal article, and I'd say, by all means, read that State Journal article. It's very clear that what happened in the budget process that he's talking about was reallocation of American Recovery Plan dollars that weren't used by some efforts and were being transferred to other efforts. So there's in no case ever a reduction of funding to Second Harvest, as he claims. There's a difference of proposals from the executive proposing $6 million and the county board choosing to add $4.5 million to Second Harvest efforts and invest $1.5 million in housing needs and other food pantries and a number of fundamental needs. And what he also leaves out of the record is the fact that days after we adopted that budget, we also added an additional $1.7 million to Second Harvest from our interest earnings. And so combined, Second Harvest got $231,000 more than the executive's original proposal.
So, in general, I'm curious to hear what your priorities are for the county as a whole in the future.
For the county as a whole, you know, in my role as county board chair, I certainly see a number of areas of effort that are required, and some of those include working with our state partners to address regulatory barriers to creating a crisis triage center. But, you know, one of the things our budget accomplished this year was expanding crisis response for us to be able to fully realize the ability to implement something like the city's CARES model. We need to have a crisis triage center for first responders to be able to take people who are having a behavioral health crisis or mental health issue, for them to be able to go to a crisis triage center rather than to the county jail or to emergency rooms. Another area of significant need that I think has gone underreported is our need to expand housing, and housing that people at all different income levels can afford. And so that's why I think our work in the regional housing strategy effort has been really important. That's an effort where we're working with community leaders from around the county, housing stakeholders like Realtors Association, the Madison Area Builders Association, and others to turn the recommendations coming out of the initial work of the housing strategy into action.
Meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race? And if reelected to the county board, how do you plan to handle that transition?
If reelected, I will be also running to be reelected to the county board chair. And so when the executive resigns, and his official last day is May 3rd, when he resigns, the county board chair assumes the duties of the executive and has 30 days to appoint an interim to hold the seat until the special election in November. So in looking at a person to fill that interim role who would not appoint anybody that's running for the seat or is a strong supporter of one of the candidates, but rather it's an important time for a person in that role to be working with all the departments on developing the budget proposal for the fall. We need somebody who's familiar with county government and the budgeting process and who, like I said, will not be running for the seat in the end.
Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
So I am very invested in taking care of the things the people of District 34 care about. I'm endorsed by South Central Federation of Labor by unanimous vote of their 90 affiliate union organizations, both from the public and private sectors. Our friends at AFSCME, Fair Wisconsin, and Clean Wisconsin, Adelante, and then many leaders as well, from Congressman Mark Pocan to state leaders like Senators Diane Hesselbein and Melissa Agard, and many local leaders here in the community and community members. My 18 years of experience in county budgeting and my sense of relationships with stakeholders gives me the tools and partnerships we need to deliver on crucial priorities. It's an important time for somebody with my experience as well. Like you mentioned, we'll be seeing a new county executive around the corner, and add to that, nearly two-thirds of the county board are going to be new, either in their first or their second term. So I think it's an important time for somebody with my experience and institutional knowledge to provide that continuity of leadership as we navigate these transitions.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Patrick.
Sure. Well, thank you for the opportunity to inform your listeners about my candidacy.
That was incumbent supervisor Patrick Miles, one of two candidates vying for the District 34 seat on the Dane County Board. District 34 represents McFarland and the surrounding area. We heard from his challenger, Ed Ray, earlier in the show. Miles and Ray will face off on April 2nd.
You are listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of our show. We hear from West High School's award-winning mock trial team. We take a closer look at safe drinking water. We get the details on a popular cocktail. And we review two movies streaming on the small screen.
But now we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
Hola y bienvenido. Are you interested in learning about poets who write in the Spanish language, then are translated into English and published in bilingual editions? On Monday, March 18th at 7 o'clock p.m., the WORT Access Hour will be presenting a special program, Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish, discussing the ongoing process of translations, its similarities and differences, its joys and pitfalls. Host James P. Roberts and guest Diego Alegría will share examples of their favorite poets and how reading them has affected their own poetry. That's Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish on Monday, March 18th at 7 o'clock p.m. on the Access Hour.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
BBC News with Eileen McHugh. Israel and the US say two high-ranking Hamas commanders have been killed in recent fighting in Gaza. They were named as its third most senior commander, Marwan Issa, and the head of operations in its internal security force, Farik Mabouok. Lawyers for Donald Trump say he's been unable to secure a multi-million dollar bond that would enable him to appeal against a fraud case judgment in New York. If he can't produce the funds, the state authorities could start seizing his properties. The US Supreme Court has rejected a request by Donald Trump's former aide, Peter Navarro, to avoid prison while he appeals against a conviction for contempt of Congress. He had refused to testify before a panel investigating the attack on the US Capitol building. Parliament in the Gambia has voted to revoke a ban on female genital mutilation, removing legal protections for millions of girls. Human rights activists say the move will undo decades of work. President Putin has held a rally in Red Square on the 10th anniversary of Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea. He told a triumphant crowd that the occupied Ukrainian territories would never be relinquished. The European Union has agreed to increase military support for Ukraine by more than $5 billion. It will be available for training and buying arms and equipment. The US software giant NVIDIA has unveiled its latest artificial intelligence chip, which has 208 billion transistors. The company said this made it more than twice as powerful at training AI models than the previous best chip. And an original pair of ruby slippers worn by Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz are to go on a world tour before being sold at auction in December. The shoes are one of four surviving pairs from the film. BBC News.
The time now is 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. Thanks for tuning in tonight.
March came in like a lion for Madison West High School's mock trial team. They are the new state champions after winning a case against Milwaukee's Shorewood High School. In May, they'll head to Wilmington, Delaware to try a case in the U.S. National Mock Trial Competition. WORT's Andy Moore sat down with the state champions on Friday.
We have a studio filled with team members right now, and we'll gavel them together here. We welcome state champion team captains Ari Blathert. I did pretty well, I think, on that. Bren Ronk and Caleb Ellenberg. Welcome. Also with us is co-coach Kendall Harrison. Good morning, counselors, and welcome to the Friday Buzz. Let's start with the win itself, if we may. Ari, is there a jury that hands out a decision, or how is the winner of a mock trial determined?
So we usually have three judges, two scoring judges that sort of rank every performance, and then one presiding judge that gives their sort of overall opinion of the case.
Bryn, what did it feel like to win the case?
Pretty good. It's West's first time winning the state tournament, so I think for all of us as seniors who have been participating in the program for all 4 years, it was pretty rewarding.
How much time, Bryn, between the conclusion of the trial and the time that it took for the judges to consider, how much time passed before your win was announced?
Only a couple minutes, and that's the really nice thing, is at the state final, the judges disclose.
Caleb, what was the case that you won the state championship? What was the case about in that trial?
Yes, so the name of the case was Flynn Forrester versus Sam Sargent, and it was a case of mysterious mushrooms. Flynn Forrester and Sam Sargent were friends, and Sam Sargent brought these mushrooms back from Washington, and it's a little bit, the facts are a little bit disputed on this point. That's what we were arguing about in trial, but basically, either Sam offered Flynn these mushrooms and told them they were hallucinogenic, or Sam just showed Flynn the mushrooms and Flynn grabbed them, and it's this disputed case. But what ended up happening, unfortunately, is Flynn, who is fictional, ended up almost dying because the mushrooms were poisonous.
Oh my, and the West team was the plaintiff, is that correct?
We have two teams on both sides. Okay. So I was on our defense side and Arjen Bruner on the plaintiff side.
Oh, my. Okay, so this divided even between one single entry team, is that correct?
Yes.
Ari, did you guys win cases at the competition on your way to the trial against Shorewood?
Yes.
How much time does a team have during the competition to prepare? When are the terms, and for want of a better word, of a case presented to you, Ari?
The case usually drops around the beginning of October, and then we have from October until February when our regional competition is, and then the teams that do well at regionals advance to the state competition in March. And then we have the whole state competition.
That's cool, because it seems like that in the real world, that would be perhaps approximately as much time as a law firm might have. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with members and a co-coach of the West High School state champion mock trial team. I'm going to talk with the team's coach now for a minute. But before I do, fair warning, team members, in a minute, I'm going to come back to each of you, and I'm going to ask you what you believe is the most valuable skill a trial attorney must have. So think about that. And meanwhile, Coach Kendall Harrison, what is a practice look like for a mock trial team? What are the drills?
We spend a lot of time scrimmaging amongst ourselves and actually doing practice trials. We also spend a fair bit of time thinking about and learning the rules of evidence and really the art of storytelling, because at the end of the day, the team that ends up doing the best is usually the one that tells the best story.
Well, you know, I think that was proven even by Caleb's colorful description of that mushroom case. And so I really like that element of it. And that, after all, is an art of persuasion, right?
It absolutely is, and that's one of the things that I think is so great about mock trial. It gives kids an opportunity to be part of a team, to learn many valuable skills going forward in life, but one of the things we talk about a lot is you're learning to persuade, and there are many ways to do that. You can do that with the mind, you can do that with the heart, and you got to figure out how to bring all these things together in a single unit to be as persuasive as you possibly can.
Okay, we're going to now come back to the students, and they've had a moment to think about this important question. Ari, the most valuable asset, in your opinion, a trial attorney must have?
I think the ability to think on one's feet. So, you know, throughout the trial, we are making objections, responding to objections to try and keep evidence in or out. And it's oftentimes things that we've never heard before. Most of the trial is pretty rehearsed and standard, but then the objections are where you really have to think on your feet, and that's a lot of times where the difference is.
Okay, Bryn, the most valuable asset a trial attorney must have.
I'm going to echo what Kendall said about storytelling. We're given 40 minutes to present a case in mock trial, so I think the ability to kind of like crystallize all the facts that you're presented with in the case materials and use those effectively to persuade the jury.
There's so many applications to that ability, aren't there, Coach, with regards to being concise, being clear, making your point, getting out.
And also just learning to build confidence, because there's nothing that will give you a boost like standing in front of a room of people and having to adapt to the moment and then afterwards thinking, yeah, I can do that.
It's really quite inspiring. It's a great opportunity. We've got Caleb now. You've had an extra 30 seconds, and I know that time matters. The most valuable asset a trial attorney must have, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, absolutely echoing what Ari and Bryn said, and I also think teamwork. You know, our state team is 12 people, but there have been more than 50 people involved in our mock trial organization this year. And both in the trial itself, when you have your co-counsel and talking to them, well, more often we pass sticky notes. It's kind of exciting. We're like hurriedly passing notes, writing things during the trial. But then throughout the year, this team, like, we all practice together, all 50 of us, and we work together, we build off each other's ideas, and mock trial is really a team sport, or a sport if you want to call it that.
Yes.
But we all work together, and I think that's really important.
Caleb, do you know what the case is you must, that you'll have to try in Delaware at the Nationals?
Actually, no. That's part of the excitement, or the fun of it, and maybe the pressure of it too. But for Nationals, they really want to test your ability to prep on a short time period, so they're going to announce the case at the end of March, so we'll have about a month to prepare our case.
That's quite a bit a different time spread than that October drop. Not exactly the day before either, but that's going to be a lot of work. How many hours now, this is getting personal, but how many hours like a sports commitment. Are you giving this, and will you, between now and the May National Championships, Bryn, how many hours a week do you think?
I think, well, this is our first time going to Nationals, so I don't exactly know if we all know what the time commitment is going to be like. I think we're anticipating that we're going to, you know, have to take things up a notch, obviously. But between now and when the case is dropping, we're also going to be going over, there are new rules of evidence, new competition rules. So the work doesn't start on March 29th. It's starting now, really.
Do you guys know all the lawyer jokes?
Would you like to tell one?
Well, I do have one, but I was wondering if you had any. I play the banjo. There's a lot of banjo jokes, and it seems like there's a lot of lawyer jokes, too. Are you going to make me tell it?
Yeah, tell it.
All right. A man walked into a lawyer's office and inquired about the lawyer's rates. $250 for three questions, replied the lawyer. Isn't that awfully steep? Asked the man. Yes, the lawyer replied. And what was your third question? I don't know. This is kind of getting personal, and I don't want to assume anything about what we can draw from your commitment to this activity and where you see yourself in 10 years, but where do you see yourself in 10 years, Ari?
Well, I am hoping to pursue music in some form throughout my life, and then I'm also hoping to be some form of scientific researcher as well.
Bryn?
I have absolutely no idea, and I'm so sorry that I can't give you a better answer.
I don't be sorry. I think that's the best answer of all. You're making the best of things right now, and that's for sure. And Caleb?
I mean, I guess I'm going to be the only one who maybe echoes what you might expect us to say. I'm thinking about maybe being a lawyer. But again, like Bryn, who knows where I'll end up. But it's funny because the judges at the end of almost every trial are always asking us. They're like, okay, you all were really good. Who wants to be a lawyer? And in my freshman year, there was a trial where I didn't raise my hand. No one else raised their hand. And the judge was like, why? Why is no one raising their hand? So over the course of my time in this club, they've convinced me to think about being a lawyer. I think that'd be a cool job.
Caleb Ellenberg, Bryn Ronk, Ari Blehart, and Coach Kendall Harrison, all from the new state champion mock trial team from Madison West High School, the Regents. Thank you for coming into the studio this morning, and please leave your business cards at the front desk. Thank you.
From a fellow Memorial Spartan, congrats to the Regents mock trial team. This Friday, March 22nd, is World Water Day. The United Nations started the event in 1993 to emphasize the importance of water and inspire action. In this edition of The Past Isn't Past, feature contributor Harry Richardson highlights some fights for safe, clean water in the United States.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong.
This Friday, March 22nd, is World Water Day, an annual United Nations observance that raises awareness and inspires action to tackle the water crisis. The first World Water Day was in 1993. The UN issues an annual themed report. 2024's report is Water for Peace. With the growing global climate crisis, water use will only grow in importance. The UN says water can create or spark conflict. When people have unequal or no access, tensions can rise between communities and countries. More than 3 billion people worldwide depend on water that crosses national borders. Yet out of 153 countries, only 24 report having cooperation agreements for all their shared water. Over 2 billion people live without safely managed water services, with devastating impacts for their lives and wider society. In the U.S., meanwhile, the drinking water is broken in so many ways, says a recent article for the National Resources Defense Council, NRDC. Chronic underinvestment has left the nation's water infrastructure outdated and on the verge of collapse. Historic flooding damaged Jackson, Mississippi's water treatment plant, leaving more than 150,000 people without safe drinking water for weeks. This drew national attention to Jackson, a black-majority city, and exposed the water issues that residents there have been shouldering for decades and continue to do so. Meanwhile, lead, per- and polyfluoroalkali substances known as PFAS, industrial pollution, and agricultural runoff are contaminating the drinking water for hundreds of millions of people, and many don't even know it. Buffalo, New York has widespread problems with lead pipes. 64% of the houses are 80 years old, the nation's oldest housing stock. Nearly 6% of Buffalo's children have elevated levels of lead in their blood, triple the exposure rate of Flint, Michigan, a decade ago. More than half of the city's water service lines contain lead. Local community groups, the NRDC, and a national nonprofit, We Act for Environmental Justice, pinpointed where the lead pipes are. The city plans to use that data to create online interactive maps. City officials say replacing all the lead pipes could take decades and cost up to $500 million. Local activists continue to fight. EPA recently estimated that there are over 90 million service lines across all 50 states with lead contaminants. An earlier NRDC study put the number between almost 10 million to almost 13 million. Between 2018 and 2020, at least 186 million people drank from water systems with lead levels exceeding one part per billion, the level recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics to protect children. A stronger EPA rule on lead and copper would be crucial to replacing all of the country's lead pipes within a decade. An agency plan update is due this October. Houston has nearly two dozen Superfund sites that the EPA has prioritized for cleanup. Local activists report there are another 2,000 former and potentially polluted industrial sites. Houston recently discovered it also has widespread high levels of PFAS. Scientists have linked exposure to these synthetic forever chemicals, so named because they don't break down, with cancer, developmental issues, and immune system problems. Last March, the EPA proposed to regulate PFAS in tap water, but the agency plans to cover only 6 of the roughly 14 types of PFAS. The agency estimates that 6,300 of the country's drinking water systems serving 94 million people contain levels of PFAS that would violate their proposed standards. Still, since the EPA requires water systems to monitor for only 29 kinds of PFAS, NRDC researchers suggest more expansive testing would show even more widespread contamination. Meanwhile, manufacturers continue to pollute without regulation or a requirement to fix their damage. Pervasive PFAS contamination is a national water crisis, yet NRDC Senior Strategic Director for Health Eric D. Olson describes as a 5-alarm fire. Regulating PFAS as a single class of chemicals would better protect people because it would make monitoring, testing, cleaning up, and ultimately discontinuing the production of these dangerous chemicals easier. A lasting solution to the nation's aging infrastructure would require a national effort. The NRDC has found that while $30 billion through the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law helped jumpstart improvements to water treatment systems, $109 billion per year over the next 20 years would be needed to really fix the problem, and any such program would need to prioritize disadvantaged communities. To observe World Water Day locally, check out cityofmadison.com. But don't forget, clean water begins at home. For the past is the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's now 6:48 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
The 7 and 7 is a staple in bars across the country, and you may have heard of it. But where does it come from, and how is it made? Reporter Charlie Bielowski has the details in this archival edition of Madison Mixology.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite reporter, Charlie Bielowski. Today, I have a quick and easy cocktail for you to try, the 7 and 7. You may have heard of this drink before if you frequent bars or maybe even at a restaurant. It's been around since the 1950s thanks to a collaboration between the 7-Up soda brand and Seagram's Distillery. The cocktail was conceived to help promote and highlight Seagram's 7 Crown Whiskey, using the lemon-lime soda to complement its smooth flavor. The population of 7 and 7 peaked in the 1970s, thanks to its simplicity in preparation and refreshing flavor. As bars and restaurants adopted the new drink to their menus, it became a common choice for consumers. Making this drink is incredibly simple. To start, grab a glass and add some ice. Then you want to add 1.5 to 2 ounces of Seagram 7 whiskey. To finish it off, add about 4 ounces of 7-Up soda. Now that we got our drink, it's time to taste test. Down the hatch. I suppose I was expecting the whiskey to be a lot sharper and a lot more warm going down the throat. But in all reality, with the 7-Up mixed in, it's incredibly pleasant. It really brings out, you know, a really sweet taste. And it's more like just kind of boozy 7-Up, to be completely honest. The flavors help bring each other out more, I guess, both for the 7-Up and for the Seagram 7. The Seagram 7, well, the 7 and 7 itself isn't really a go-to drink for me, but I have to say it is not bad, not at all. It's very good, actually, very pleasant, citrusy, refreshing. Over time, the original 7 and 7 recipe has evolved and changed in new and interesting ways. One example is the ginger 7 and 7, which incorporates ginger ale for 7-Up, and the southern 7 and 7, which incorporates bourbon in the place of the blended whiskey. There's other ones too, like the raspberry 7-Up, where you like throw in a splash of, you know, raspberry liqueur, or even a 7 and 7 with grenadine as well, which is, it adds a nice kind of cherry splash to the citrusy taste. Try this easy combination for yourself, and I'll see you next week with another great cocktail. I'm your host, Charlie Bielowski, and this has been another installment of Madison Mixology.
We'll now hear Harry Richardson's reviews of two movies on the small screen. American Conspiracy: The Octopus Murders just started streaming on Netflix, and it explores the mysterious death of investigative reporter Danny Casolaro. And Diggers came out in 2006, but recently started streaming on several services. Harry says Diggers is a good, melancholy story about working class people. It's set on Long Island in the 1970s and follows the area's clamming community.
Reporter Danny Casolaro was found dead over the weekend in a motel in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Local authorities quickly ruled his death a suicide.
It didn't sit right. In my mind, I'm thinking they killed him.
And that was a clip from the trailer for a new documentary, American Conspiracy: The Octopus Murders, directed by Zachary Treats. Treats became involved in the story of an investigative journalist, Danny Casolaro, through a childhood friend, journalist Christian Hansen. Casolaro was investigating a sort of grand United conspiracy theory when he died under mysterious circumstances in a hotel room in 1991. He was 44. He had been working on a case for about a year that involved 8 men, formerly highly placed intelligence officials. The case involved drugs, guns, murder, and mayhem across several continents. The quest grew out of an article Casolaro wrote for a software publication, Computer Age. The story involved a technology information company called InsLaw. The company claimed in a lawsuit that the U.S. Department of Justice had illegally used the software it sold to the department. Two lower courts ruled in favor of the software developer, Bill Hamilton, in 1988, but that was overturned on appeal in 1991. Hamilton charged that backdoors had been inserted into the program so that whoever bought a copy of the program could be spied upon. The major source for this theory for Hamilton and later Casolaro was Michael Roccanasciutto. Roccanasciutto claimed in an affidavit in InsLaw case to have created the backdoor. Roccanasciutto was a high-tech genius with an arrest years earlier for manufacturing illegal drugs. Roccanasciutto claimed when he was working for Wackenhut Cabazon Project, he was given a copy of the software by Earl Bryan to do the modifications. the security company Wagonhut had several former high-level intelligence personnel on its board of directors. A number of unusual operations were taking place. Cabazon Indian Reservation in Southern California. Casalero's research on the Insula case brought him to Rokana Shuto, who claimed he traveled with Earl Bryan, a longtime associate of the future Attorney General Ed Meese, and then presidential candidate Ronald Reagan, to Iran in 1980. Rokana Shuto said that they met with Iranians and gave them $40 million, keep U.S. hostages there until after the presidential election. Rokana Shuto then spun a tale of a vast conspiracy, becoming Casalero's and later Christian Hansen's main witness. The four-part, 50-minute each series details this conspiracy to a not very satisfying conclusion. It's unclear if Casalero and therefore Hansen were on to anything real or not. Casalero came in contact with some pretty shady, dangerous people following this case that would have had no scruples about killing him. This makes believable his friends and family's position that he did not commit suicide, but was killed. Three or four slashes on his left hand and seven or eight on his right hand seem implausible to have done himself. Up next, a well-done period piece.
Kids need to know at the end of life, people die.
Babies, do you want to go to a funeral?
No!
Who wants to see a dead body?
Me!
That was clipped from the trailer for Diggers, directed by Catherine Dykeman, from a melancholy, well-constructed screenplay by actor Ken Marino. The movie came out in 2006 and is on several streaming services. This is a well-done film with a good cast, with a lot of empathy for the people of this time and place. Marino grew up in this community and has said it was a tribute to his dad. The story plays out over several weeks in 1976 on Long Island in a working-class town where our four friends are clam diggers who see the end coming. All the good clamming areas have been bought up by a big company, and they are left with the dregs. Early in the movie, the company buys yet another bed that is then forbidden to locals. Our story opens with Hunt, Paul Rudd, reluctant to get out of bed and just letting that phone ring. He knows his dad is on the other end and is waiting for him to join him on the water. Hunt is late, as usual. Hunt stops off at the local diner where his sister Gina, Mara Turney, works the grill, cigarette in one hand and spatula in the other. Almost everybody in the movie smokes. He's soon off to the boat with a cup of coffee for his dad as a peace offering. He sees his dad's boat, but something is wrong. In the next scene, Hunt and his sister are looking at their dad in an open casket. He's wearing a suit, which is oddly out of place with his life. Their dad never wore a suit. Strangely, but fittingly, he's still wearing his work waders. Gina jokes that they should strip him down to his dirty underwear with a drink in one hand and the TV guide in the other. This scene sets the tone for the film with the appearances of our main characters and their tight-knit, somewhat dysfunctional relationships. All in all, a well-done film worth watching. A fairly rare Hollywood movie that deals realistically and respectfully with working-class people's lives. For WT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thank you so much for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Special thanks to feature contributors Andy Moore, Charlie Bielowski, and Harry Richardson. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production and Bill Kingsbury for web production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial. It's called The Access Hour. Have a good night.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.
Hola y bienvenidos. Welcome to the Access Hour. I am your host, James P. Roberts, and tonight we are presenting a special program called Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish, where we will be talking about our favorite poets and how reading them in English and Spanish has affected our own poetry, perhaps. Before we begin, and my host tonight is Diego Alegría, but before we get to Diego, I'd like to give you a little background on my own early introduction to the Spanish language. I was born and grew up in Waterloo, Iowa, and went to a Catholic parochial high school, Columbus High. I had some older sisters and brothers, and one of the Columbus High textbooks that I found in our house was called El Camino Real by Edith Jarrett and Beryl McManus from 1953. And it became my introduction to the Spanish language and got me interested in trying to learn more.